William James, one of the few philosophers who knows how to write, said that most of philosophy is meaningless because their questions don't make a difference. Which way you answer the question, if it makes a difference, makes the question meaningful. If not, not. He gives the example of a hunting expedition he was on with two other philosophers. They sat down and watched two squirrels chase each other around the tree. Philosopher A said to philosopher B, "Each squirrel circumambulates the tree, right?" "Right," said B. "Does each squirrel also circumambulate the other squirrel?" "No," said B, "because they're always in motion and neither of them ever catches the other or stays still." "Oh, yes, they do," said A, "because circumambulation is a transitive relationship. If you circumambulate the tree, you must circumambulate each other." "Not so," said B. They argued for a half hour, stalked off in opposite directions, calling each other hopeless dunderheads, and vowed never to speak to each other again. William James said, "I think I have just seen the history of Western philosophy." Many questions don't make a difference. For instance, Hegel, that paragon of meaninglessness, said that time is not noumenal but phenomenal. It's not really, really real. It's only apparently real. One philosopher, G.E. Moore, said, "I would like to ask Hegel, does that mean that I didn't really eat my lunch after I ate my breakfast, but only thought I did?" If he says that, he's insane. If that's not what it means, then why does he use such fancy words to say what we already know? I like that kind of simplicity. Socrates had it. And if there's any question that makes a difference and is therefore very meaningful, is the question, is there a God? Here we are, on a stage. Did anybody write the play? Or are we ad-libbing our lines? That's obviously a question that makes an enormous difference. Many atheists know that it makes a difference. Sartre says, "The atheists of the French Revolution thought that God didn't make a difference. We want to discard this unscientific hypothesis, but meanwhile, we must get on with the business of living, which is to be good to each other and to seek the truth and to have children and to keep the human race going." "Why?" says Sartre. He prefers Dostoevsky. "If there is no God, then everything is permissible, but nothing is meaningful. It makes a difference." Freud, another atheist, knew that the existence of God made a difference. He classified religious faith as a species of insanity, collective insanity, which, of course, it is if it isn't true. Imagine Jimmy Stewart in that old movie, Harvey. He believes in this 16-foot-high invisible rabbit, Harvey. He's the most important person in his life. He always consults Harvey before he makes a decision. He talks to Harvey. Harvey doesn't exist. Well, if you believe in God and God doesn't exist, you're more insane than Jimmy Stewart, because God's more important than Harvey. So obviously this makes a difference. Different kinds of gods make different kinds of differences. The bigger the god, the bigger the difference. The pagan gods make differences. If you believe in Neptune, you might placate him so that you can survive a storm at sea. But if there's one God who is omnipotent and created the universe, then he makes all the difference in the world. The difference between non-being and being, that's an infinite difference. If a God can bring you from danger to safety or from disease to health, that's a pretty big difference. But if a God can bring you from non-existence to existence by the act of creation, well, that's an infinite difference. So the most important question is the existence of God, and the most important kind of God is the Judeo-Christian Muslim God who creates the entire universe, who makes an infinite difference. So let's talk about whether such a God exists. Can you prove that God exists? Yes and no. All proofs have limits. To prove that I exist, that's rather more difficult than you might think. To prove that this podium exists, that's quite possible. But can you prove everything about the podium or about me or anything else? Well, no. You can only prove a slice of something. And that's certainly true of God. And I think the slice of God that you can prove exists is a very thin slice indeed. It's enough to refute the atheist, but I don't want to give anybody false hopes. I do not think that you can prove everything the Bible means by God. But I do think that you can prove that a being exists that has some of those attributes. If there is a God, then he must be to us something like we are to a snail or a slug. And we must know about as much about him as the snail or slug knows about us. So if we're to know any more than that thin slice, he has to take the initiative. Thus, the notion of a divine revelation and of the human belief in a divine revelation. Faith and revelation are correlative terms, like color and sight. Faith simply means believing in a revelation. The notion that God has revealed himself and that it makes sense to believe in the things that he has revealed, even though you can't prove them, that in itself is a reasonable notion, although I don't think it can be proved. But it's a reasonable notion because if you use an analogy and look at all the things in the universe in a kind of a hierarchy, you find that if you're thinking simply about an idea, like a mathematical number, then you have total control of the situation. It can't do anything. If you're thinking about a thing that's real, independent of your consciousness, like a rock, well, all the activity is on your side. The rock can't move away and hide and lie to you, but there's a lot of stuff about the rock that you don't know. Then if you look at a living thing, like a plant, you can't totally predict what it's going to be tomorrow, at least not as well as what the rock's going to be tomorrow. So that's even harder to know. Then when you come up to the animal level, well, you have to win the confidence of an animal before it'll reveal itself to you. Some people have a way with animals, some people don't. When it comes to another human being, the activity is 50-50. If you want to know somebody, that somebody has to freely choose to reveal themselves to you, and you have to freely choose to be open to them. When it comes to a creature superior to a human being, like an angel, most of the activity has to be on the side of the superior. Finally, when it comes to God, all the activity has to be on God's part. Now, that activity, I think, is twofold. First of all, God creates you and gives you a mind, which is by nature capable of reasoning back to its creator. Even Frankenstein could do that. But then God also supplies need-to-know information that the mind in its present state is inadequate to perform. Thus, the notion of religious faith and the notion of natural reason both fit into the scheme, into the hypothesis that there is a creator God. Another consequence of that hypothesis is that nothing in faith and reason can ever contradict. There cannot be, in principle, a single contradiction between anything that can be proved by the proper use of natural human reason and the things that are proposed for belief by God by divine revelation. If you find a single such contradiction, the hypothesis is refuted. That makes the biblical God very vulnerable to disproof. He's still around, though. I don't think, however, that he is sitting with bated breath waiting to see the cogency of my proofs tonight so that he knows whether he exists or not. What kind of proof am I talking about? Well, let's distinguish a number of different questions. First of all, whether God exists. A thing can exist without us knowing it. Secondly, whether we can know that God exists. A thing can be known without there being certain knowledge. Thirdly, whether that knowledge is certain. But a thing can be certain without you being able to prove to someone else that certainty. For instance, I am certain that I exist, but I don't think I can prove to you that I exist. You may disagree. I think Descartes failed. Fourth, you may be able to prove a thing with certainty, but the proof is not yet a scientific proof. The scientific method is probably the greatest invention in the entire history of science. It's like a skeleton key that enables us to make all the other discoveries. But not everything follows the scientific method. You cannot prove that your wife or husband loves you by the scientific method. You cannot prove that life has any meaning whatsoever by the scientific method. You cannot prove that beauty is better than ugliness by the scientific method. So I do not think that you can prove that there exists a God by the scientific method. Some people may disagree with that, but I do think you can prove that God exists by good logic. There's two extremes then. The rationalist extreme is to either prove everything about God or claim to prove God by the scientific method. I don't think that can be done. The irrationalist extreme is it doesn't matter. It feels nice, so I'm going to believe anyway. There are various kinds of proofs. There's a practical proof and a theoretical proof. A practical proof doesn't prove that God exists. It simply proves that it's practical to believe in him. The most famous of these is Pascal's wager. I'm going to give 7 proofs for the existence of God tonight. That's the first one. The second kind of proof is theoretical proof, proof that proves that something is the case, whether it's practical or not. To quote William James once again, there's two kinds of people in the world, the tender-minded and the tough-minded. The tender-minded put practice above theory. The tough-minded put theory above practice. The tender-minded think that happiness is the most important thing. The tough-minded think that truth is the most important thing. The tender-minded start with their own feelings. The tough-minded start with facts. It seems to me that good philosophers are all tough-minded. So I'm not going to give any tender-minded proof. However, some proofs are only probable and some are certain. I will give one probable proof. That might be a contradiction in terms, if you mean by a proof a certain demonstration. But the proof that's often called the argument from common consent, I think, is a very reasonable reason for believing in God, even though it doesn't prove that God exists. The other proofs, I believe, are certain. I know of at least 24 dozen, probably 48 dozen, proofs for the existence of God that claim to be certain. I think at least half of them are valid. I don't think, by the way, that Anselm's ontological argument is valid, but I do think that, well, the following 5 proofs are valid. 1, the argument from the first cause, or the contingency argument. 2, the design argument. 3, the moral argument. 4, the argument from desire. And 5, the existential argument. The 5 proofs of Thomas Aquinas all fit under the first cause or contingency argument. But before we get to those 5 proofs, let me very briefly review arguments that are practical and arguments that are probable. Pascal's wager is my students' most popular proof. They like it the best. That proves nothing. They're in Massachusetts. But there are more philosophers, however, in Boston per capita than any other city on earth. The reason is philosophy is the love of wisdom, and wisdom comes from suffering. Somebody said to me, why do I wear this in New York? Do I have a death wish? And I say, no, I meet Yankee fans and we get along famously. I just say, we all know our place. I am the masochist, you are the sadist. There are certain things like the law of non-contradiction that are absolutely certain. Pascal's wager is an argument for skeptics, for those who don't think there's any good proof for or against the existence of God, so they wonder, since they have no tough-minded argument, whether there's a good tender-minded argument. And Pascal says there certainly is. It's a bet. What can you win? There's 2 things everybody wants, truth and happiness. According to the skeptic, you can't find the truth about God, no matter how hard you try. Well, let's calculate on happiness then. If there's a God, and if you believe in him, then you attain eternal happiness. That's a good bet. However, suppose there's no God. Well, then if you believe in him, it doesn't do you any harm. There's no payoff. There's no winning or losing after death. But if you don't believe in him, then once again, if there is no God, it doesn't do you any harm. There is no life after death, no heaven or hell. But if there is a God, does it do you any harm? Well, suppose I say, I have here $1,000,000 and I'll give it to you for free if you come and take it from my hand. And if you don't trust me, you don't have $1,000,000. You've lost something that's enormously valuable for no reason at all. In other words, the only possible combination of winning is 1, God in fact exists, and 2, I believe in him. The only possible way to lose is 1, God exists, and 2, I refuse to believe in him. If God doesn't exist, then you don't either win or lose in the next life when you will find out. And nobody can prove whether you're winning or losing in this life if you're a skeptic and you don't think you can prove God exists or not. So since the only possibility of winning is to believe in God and the only possibility of losing is not to believe in God, belief is the world's best bet. Now, that's very crass and crude and selfish and has almost nothing to do with religious faith, except that it'll scare you away from atheism. And God, who is love, stoops to conquer. And he will accept even the most ridiculous of our attempts to come to him. 2, the argument from common consent. This is seldom given anymore, and I'm surprised at that, because in the past, when human consciousness and human society was hierarchical rather than egalitarian, it was a very popular proof. Whereas today, when almost everyone is egalitarian and suspicious of hierarchy, it's hardly ever given. The argument is the vast majority of all human beings in all times, places, and cultures have believed in some sort of a God. Therefore, it is very likely to be true. Or to put it differently, in order to be an atheist, you must be a snob. You must believe that you stand among the very small minority who are liberated from mankind's most pervasive superstition. That doesn't prove anything, but at least it ought to make you worry a little bit. Now let me go into the five serious arguments for the existence of God. The first cause argument is in one sense very simple and in another sense very complicated. The simple form is this. Let us define a first cause as an absolutely first cause, an uncaused cause, something that causes other things but is not itself caused. If there is a God, God would be a first cause. A creator is by definition a first cause of everything but himself. Now, either there is a first cause or not. If there is no first cause, then there are no second causes either, because second causes operate only if they're caused by a first cause, whether there's only one second cause or a finite number or even an infinite number. Think of a train. The locomotive pulls the cars and itself. The cars can't pull themselves. They can only pull each other, but they can pull each other only if they're pulled by the locomotive. If there is no locomotive, there can't be a train, whether there's one car or 10 or a million. So unless there is an uncaused cause, there can't be second causes. That seems to be a logical principle. You can deduce that simply by an analysis of the meaning of the word cause. The second premise is a sense observation. There are second causes. There are caused causes. In fact, the entire universe is an enormous 18 billion year long series of trains or dominoes or caused causes. I'll put the two premises together. If no first cause, no second causes, there are second causes, therefore there must be a first cause. First doesn't necessarily mean temporally first. This piece of paper is being held up by this podium. The podium exercises a causal effect on the piece of paper. It prevents it from falling down. But the podium doesn't exert its causality first in time, and then after it finishes, then the paper begins to be held up. The cause and the effect are simultaneous. So God doesn't have to be in time in order to be the first cause. He could be the simultaneous giver of existence to everything that exists. Another version of this argument is the contingency argument. That's a little more abstract. One way of formulating it is this. A thing exists, and a thing has an essence or a nature. I exist and I have human nature. A horse exists and it has the nature of a horse. A unicorn does not exist, but it has the nature of a unicorn. Now, nothing exists simply because of its essence. A unicorn has a perfectly good essence and so does a horse, but a horse happens to exist and a unicorn doesn't, because whatever forces brought a horse into existence but didn't bring a unicorn into existence. We see nothing in the universe and we can imagine nothing in the universe whose essence accounts for its existence. Therefore, everything in the universe is contingent on something else with respect to its existence. Analyze its own inner being, and you'll find this distinction between its essence and its existence. Now, if there is a God, God is not a creature, but the creator. So God does not receive existence from anything else. He is not contingent on some other being for his existence. Nevertheless, he exists. Therefore, he must exist by his own essence. Necessarily. Now, is there such a God? Well, if not, then everything in the universe is contingent for its existence on nothing. If you say, but I was given existence by my parents, and they were given existence by my grandparents, and so on, you still haven't accounted for anything, not even my existence. That's like meeting a large iron chain suspended in midair and saying, why in the world doesn't it fall? And you see another link that's holding it. You don't stop there. You say, why are both links held up in the air? And then you look and you see a third link above it. And you don't stop there until you find out that there's a large crane on top of a building which is perched on the ground, which is holding that chain. But until you have something that explains itself, so to speak, you don't explain anything else. It's dependent on that something. That's probably the most abstract of all the arguments for the existence of God, but perhaps also the most profound. Aquinas tries to put it in a very concrete way, and I'm not sure whether this way is valid or not, but let me give it to you, just because it's so concrete in the other expression. If there is a necessary being, a being that has to exist, it exists eternally. It cannot ever lose its existence. That would be God. Now, everything else has the possibility to cease to exist. Everything in the universe can die. Now, if there is no God, then there is infinite time. There's no creator, therefore no act of creation, and therefore infinite time for every possibility to be actualized, including the possibility of death for everything. Well, if there's already been infinite time, then every possibility has already been actualized, so why hasn't everything already died? And once it dies, it'll never start up again. I'm not sure whether that's valid or not, but it's at least concrete. Incidentally, scientific confirmation of something like the contingency argument, I think, has come through Big Bang cosmology. 20 or 30 years ago, scientists were divided into three groups as to the origin of the universe, the steady statists and the oscillation theorists and the Big Bangers. And the steady state theorists said the universe has always been here. The oscillation theorists said that the universe continually expands and contracts like an accordion. And the Big Banger said there has been just one Big Bang, and ever since the universe has been expanding. Well, nobody is a steady statist or an oscillationist anymore. And if there's a Big Bang, there must be a Big Banger. The argument from design is probably the single most popular and comprehensible argument for the existence of God. I met a doctor once who worked in Zaire for a while, and he had to make his way into a tribe that was suspicious of outsiders, and he won their confidence and saved their lives, so he was the great white father. And they asked him all sorts of questions about life in the West, and they asked him, do you have wise men there? They said, yes, we call them philosophers. Oh, what do they believe about the gods? Well, many of them are atheists. What's that? They didn't have a word in their language for that. That means they don't believe in any gods at all. No gods at all, not one and not many, not male, not female, not in the earth, not in the sky, not good, not evil, no gods at all. There are people who believe that. And they buzzed around themselves like bees and said, how can this be? And they finally came up with a solution. These people are blind and dumb and deaf, right? They live in cellars all their lives. They have never seen a star or touched a leaf. No. There are many very simple and comprehensible versions of the design argument. If you walk down the street and notice the Empire State Building, you don't say, gee, it just happened. How about that? It just evolved. Even a thing like a watch obviously presupposes a watchmaker. Well, there is much more design in the universe than in a building or in a watch. So by analogy, it seems that the universe requires a universe builder. That analogy may be weak. No analogy in and of itself is an argument. But Aquinas' version of it, I think, works better. He says that when many beings with diverse natures work towards a common end, we can be sure that there is intelligent design behind that. If there's just random motions of the sand on a beach, that's just the wind. But if the motions make a sandcastle, we know that somebody built it. Or if there's a message, SOS, we know that somebody made it. Well, there certainly is more design in a single cell of your body than there is in any human artifice. I saw a survey once of scientists in the various sciences. They were asked, do you believe in a creator God? And the percentage who believed in God among astronomers, astrophysicists, and cosmologists was something like 90%. Also a rather large number among cell biologists. And as you get into the human sciences, it decreases until you finally get into psychiatry and sociology, where the percentage is very small. I think that's quite to be expected. The more you get into human undesign, the harder it is to see God. The more you get into natural design, the more you do see God. Many religious believers see evolution and the theory of natural selection as a threat to the design argument. I've never understood that. It seems to me that a God who wanted to play with the universe with a light hand and remain anonymous most of the time and use second causes or creative causes to do his work might very well use exactly something like natural selection to bring about the human body as nature's most perfect product. So, if anything, evolution seems to increase and make more reasonable the argument from design. The thing that is the most carefully designed thing in the universe is the human brain. We haven't yet made a computer that's quite that efficient. Now, the brain is very much like a computer. If you were riding in an airplane and the public address system said, there is no pilot, but this airplane is piloted by a computer, which has been programmed by a football player trampling over computer cards with spiked shoes this morning, you would feel perfectly content, right? No, I think you would pray. Or, this airplane has been programmed by a computer which was programmed in the following way. The keyboard was left out in a field last night, and there was a hailstorm, and the hailstones hit the typewriter keys. Again, you would not put much confidence in that plane. Well then, why do you put confidence in your brain to understand the universe and to do science if your brain is simply a product of mindless chance? 20 million years ago, there was no intelligence anywhere in the universe, as far as we know. And no one seriously maintains that the solar system was designed by extraterrestrials. So if all intelligence now is totally caused by the mindless, pointless, and purposeless and accidental colliding of atoms, then why do you trust it? These arguments from the cosmos, I'm going to get into arguments from human experience in a moment, are less interesting to us, most of us anyway, than arguments from human experience, such as the moral argument and the existential argument. But they're quite important because the attributes of God that are proved by this argument interface with the attributes of God that are proved by the other arguments. The moral argument, for instance, might prove that God is a moralist. Well, so what? Maybe he's just weak. Maybe he's just a fairy tale. Does he also have the power to create the universe? Is divine goodness and divine omnipotence together in the same God? If so, the consequences are enormous. So let's look at some of the more interior arguments. Arguments may take their data either from the external world or the internal world. There are facts that we observe with our senses, and there are facts that we observe with our interior senses. And one of the facts that we observe with our interior senses is that we all have a thing called conscience. We all make moral judgments. We all judge not merely that a thing is, but that a thing ought to be or ought not to be. That's simply a fact. Well, either moral judgments can be true or false, or they can't. Either moral judgments are simply expressions of feelings which we mistake for judgments, or they are what they seem to be. In other words, either there really is good and evil, or it's all an illusion. Almost nobody lives out the philosophy that it's all an illusion, it's all a matter of feelings, it's all a fantasy and a fairy tale. They may say it, they may write books about it, but when you treat them according to their own philosophy, it turns out that they don't really believe it. All right, if there is such a thing as good and evil, explain it. Why? If there is such a thing as moral obligation, if you are really obligated to do good and not evil, why? What is there behind the moral law? You see, there are facts about how things and people behave, and there are also moral facts, if this analysis is correct, about how people ought to behave, but often don't. What's behind these moral facts, which we often call a moral law? Mustn't there be a will behind a moral law? We feel as if we're being commanded, but we don't see anybody commanding us. Well, this used to be a very popular argument until, maybe 100 or 200 years ago, when moral objectivism, the notion that morality is objective, that moral laws are real and not just made up, became much less popular. So Cardinal Newman, back in the 19th century, formulated a version of the moral argument that should appeal even to the moral subjectivist, even to the person who says that moral rules are only things we make up. Nothing objective about them. All right, say to such a subjectivist, do you admire somebody who violates their own conscience? And they'll always say no. I admire somebody who violates the Ten Commandments, maybe, or the Quran, or the laws of the state, or any objective laws, but we got to be true to ourselves. Oh, so somebody who's a deliberately lying, hypocritical violator of their own conscience, that's not good. No, you got to be true to yourself. Why? Where does conscience get its authority from? Where did conscience come from? Is it just one of these results of mindless evolution? The brain just happens to be wired that way. Why bow down in sheepish obedience to the accidental fact that this is the way your brain happened to be wired? Why not wire it better? Or if it's just the voice of society, as Freud thinks, if conscience is just the superego unconsciously mirroring what other people want you to do, why bow down to them as if you're God? Or if it's just the training that you got from your parents, well, your parents are not infallible. But everybody, even the moral subjectivist, thinks we ought to treat conscience as if it were God's prophet. But if it isn't, why should you? But it can't be God's prophet unless there's a God. Dostoevsky's version of the argument is extremely simple. If God does not exist, then everything is permissible. When I cover Nietzsche in my classes at Boston College, I try to get across his very radical challenge to my students, and one of them is, why is there truth? Why bother with truth? Why truth? Why not rather the lie, he says. And they can't answer that. But there's another one about morality. Why be good? Why not be evil? Why not go beyond good and evil? If there is no God, why not be evil? And nobody has ever answered that question. It's an astonishingly simple question. Why not be bad? Well, because we'll catch you. No, you won't. I'm cleverer than you are. Well, we'll hate you. So what? I hate you too. I don't care if you hate me. Oh, because it's not conducive to the good of society. I know. I don't give a damn about society. Why should I? The thoroughgoing immoralist, it's very difficult to refute him if there's no God. I've got two arguments left. The argument from desire, I think, is my favorite argument because the premise is fascinating. The premise is that everybody's unhappy. Everybody desires something they can't have. Robert Browning said, a man's reach must exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? Think of the happiest time you ever had in your life. Think of the most exalted music you ever heard, or the most exalted lovemaking you ever participated in, or the most beautiful sight you ever saw, or the most wonderful intuition you ever had. Didn't it say to you, I'm just an appetizer. There's more where I come from. And haven't you looked for that more all your life? And you've never quite found it. C.S. Lewis puts it in these haunting words. All your life, an unattainable ecstasy has hovered just beyond the grasp of your consciousness. The day is coming when, after death, you will awaken to find either that beyond all hope you have it, or else it was within your grasp and you have lost it forever. The thing we desire is not to be identified with these wonderful earthly experiences that only provoke it, which are only its appetizers. In fact, that becomes clearer the happier you are. It's unhappy people who can easily be victimized by the superstition of if only. If only I had $1 million and a Learjet and a new mistress every day, I'd be happy. Well, no. Billions of people have tried that experiment. It's never worked. Not once. Not once. And yet we keep putting that car on the road hoping it'll go. To put the argument into a logical form. Premise number one, there is in the human heart a desire for something which nobody ever gets in this world. Something which can't even be imagined. Call it heaven. All right, describe heaven. Write about it. Nobody has ever written a good fiction about heaven. I don't want to live in any of your heavens or in mine. They'd be boring. I want never to be bored forever. I can't imagine that, but I want it. So we all want something we have never experienced and we can't even imagine. Premise number two, if you look at all human desires, you can classify them into two categories, natural and unnatural. The unnatural desires come from outside, from society, from advertising. I want to fly through the air like Superman. I want to go to the land of Oz. I want a World Series championship for the Boston Red Sox. These things are impossible. They will never happen. They don't exist. But I still desire them. Why? Because somebody has provoked me to desire them. But not everybody desires to fly through the air like Superman or go to the land of Oz or win a World Series. Any desire that's in everybody is innate. Desire for food, for drink, for sleep, for sex, for knowledge, for society. And there's always a corresponding state of deprivation for all natural desires. There's no such thing as Ozlessness or Supermanlessness, but there is such a thing as sleeplessness or sexlessness or knowledgelessness. It's called ignorance. It would be very, very strange indeed if, upon visiting some other planet, we found some creatures that had a passionate desire for food, but they didn't have stomachs. Or a race of creatures with only one sex who were constantly falling in love with a non-existent second sex. Couldn't be imagined. All right, so every innate desire corresponds to something real. You might not get it. You might die of starvation, but if you're hungry, there's food. Right, put the two premises together. We all want something that can't be had in this world. Anything we all want that is a natural desire exists. Therefore, there exists something that can't be had in this world. There is another world. I don't know how you can get out of that argument. I don't know why you'd want to. Final argument from one of the most complete minds that ever existed, St. Augustine, who had both an incredible intellect and an incredible heart. Medieval statuary always pictured him with a Bible in one hand and a burning heart in the other hand. I know of no one who had simultaneously a more brilliant head and a more passionate heart. I call this the existential argument. Let's begin with Augustine's definition of man. Man, for Augustine, is a living tragedy. Everybody is a living tragedy. Not only are there specifically tragic people like King Lear or Hamlet or Antigone, but all of us, necessarily, inevitably, into the human condition, there is the following tragedy. Either your life is happy or it isn't. If your life is happy, you don't want to die, but you have to die. And the happier your life is, the more tragic death is. If your life is miserable, death isn't so bad. So life is miserable either way. But more substantively, no man is an island. We need a world. We are not our own world. We need a home to make us happy. Now, there's a lot of things in nature that make us happy. There's magnificent things in nature. We're made happy by sunsets and stars and storms, but not completely. We feel like orphans, like displaced persons, like wanderers. We're pilgrims. We're looking for something better. We're trying to make the world better all the time. Maybe we're succeeding, maybe not. I sort of think we're not, because we keep taking vacations in, quote, unspoiled places. Well, why do we prefer to live in spoiled places? Anyway, the world, though very beautiful, isn't enough. It doesn't fulfill us. It also thwarts us. It gives us pleasure, but it gives us pain. It gives us life, but it gives us death. If we ask nature, nature, are you in favor of life or death? How many things have you brought into existence? How many things have you given life to? And it'll give a number, trillions and trillions. Okay, and how many have you killed or are you in process of killing? And it'll give you a number, exactly the same number. In other words, nature is like Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind. Frankly, my dear, I just don't give a damn. We do. We prefer life to death. We prefer beauty to ugliness. We prefer health to disease. Nature doesn't. Nature, says Augustine, is like a great river. On this river, everything exists. Plants and animals and arts and cultures and civilizations and people. And the river gives all this great stuff to us, and then it takes all this great stuff from us. It's not enough. All right, if we can't find our personal fulfillment, existential fulfillment in nature, what about human society? That's higher. Greater joys come from human love than from anything else. You'd rather be in love in the South Bronx than divorced in Hawaii. Is that enough? The world makes your body sort of happy. Human society makes your soul very happy, but it also makes it very unhappy. What are the biggest pains in your life? Your relatives, your family, your friends. The source of your greatest pains as well as your greatest happiness. People disappoint us. They fight wars, little ones and big ones. Betrayal, divorce, suicide, injustice, sin. Okay, we want more than that. The Stoics and the Buddhists say, yes, this is the correct analysis. Nature cannot fulfill us, society cannot fulfill us, but we find within ourselves something that fulfills ourselves. New Age people say that too. You can escape into the self. You find beauty, truth, and goodness within. You find the God within. No, you don't. You find the love of God within. You find the love of beauty, truth, and goodness within. But you also find the lack of it, the yearning for it. Romeo loves Juliet. That doesn't mean Romeo is Juliet. Even the Hindu mystic says, I don't want to be sugar. I want to taste sugar. Therefore, I don't want to be God. I want to taste God. But it seems we can't taste God. Obviously, the only answer that's going to fulfill the human heart is God. The only thing big enough to fit this infinite Grand Canyon in our souls is an infinite being. But to quote the punchline from the classic New England joke, you can't get there from here. Not only you can't get there from here, we betray God. We are not good. We are evil. We are not true. We are false. We are not beautiful. We are ugly. We are a living koan puzzle. We must have God. We can't have God. We're homing pigeons for God. We're iron filings, and God's the magnet. If there's no God, our deepest hopes are thwarted. So there is a God, yeah, but you can't get there. There's ignorance. There's weakness. There's sin. The worst barrier to our fulfillment is not the pains that come from nature or the injustices that come from human society. The biggest barrier is ourselves. And if you don't know that, well, then you're even more foolish. There's only two kinds of people in the world, Socrates thought: fools who think that they're wise and the wise who know that they're fools. And Jesus said the equivalent of, there's only two kinds of people in the world: saints who know that they're sinners and sinners who think that they're saints. In other words, we're sinners. It's an unpopular word. We're wicked. Love that word. I got four kids. One of my daughters is verbally handicapped, and she said the wisest thing any of my kids ever said. She was about five or six. She was in a group that did Saturday enrichments, and the kindergarten teacher took them around, and I was the chauffeur. And there was one of the six kids or so that was a real terror. Her name was Emily. She used to poke people's eyes out and pull their hair and whatnot when the teacher wasn't looking. And the teacher was one of these nice psychologists that kept saying, Emily, that's not what we do here. That's not appropriate behavior. Finally, after Emily had pulled somebody's hair and the teacher turned to them, heard that, Emily, that's, you know, that's not appropriate. My daughter said, teacher, why don't you tell her she's wicked? Want to meet Emily? Look in the mirror. Do you really think it would be great to meet God right now, tonight, in 2 minutes, without any hiding, without any excuses? Wouldn't that be great? If you say yes, then you're either a very great saint or a very great fool. So our only hope is not merely that God exists, and not even merely that we can meet him, but that there's some sort of mediation, some sort of way, some sort of path. But that can happen only if, astonishingly, God cares about us. Imagine you have an ant farm, and the ants rebel against you. Wouldn't you have to be a little crazy to become an ant and go down into that ant farm and die for those ants in order to save them? Well, the difference between us and an ant is not as great as the difference between us and God. And at the heart of Christianity is the claim that this is the kind of God we've got, a God who is so crazy in love with us that that's what he did. That's our only hope, that the author entered his own story and became one of us. So instead of God just sitting around wondering whether we're going to prove his existence, he takes the initiative, and he's not out there somewhere wondering whether you're going to get to him. He's the very thing that's inspiring you right now at the center of your heart to move towards him. I love Augustine's definition of God. God, he says, is that which is infinitely closer to ourselves than we can ever be to ourselves. I hope I've given you some provocative things to ask questions about. I am always amazed at how patient audiences are to sit through boring lectures. Lectures are always boring, in order to get to the interesting question and answer sessions. Your purgatory is over. Enter heaven. Questions, please.
My question is, the following: accepting the whole of the Christian revelation and looking at the writings within the Christian tradition, perhaps the most disturbing thesis that I've ever seen offered is that of the fewness of the saved. The notion that...
That's an easy one to explain.
Okay, good, because...
Jesus is not... When he says few are saved and many are not, he's not speaking as a statistician. He's speaking as a father. If I had 12 kids and one of them died, that would be one too many, and 11 is one too few.
Good.
We have no idea what the comparative population statistics of heaven and hell are. We have no idea. Period.
Professor, I went to Boston College, but I'm too old to have had you as a teacher. What are some of the profound things you've learned from your students?
Wait a minute. This is a metaphysical impossibility. You're younger than I am, and yet you're too old to have had me as a teacher. But, all right. What are the things I've learned from my students? How stupid I am. How teachers are like farmers. They throw seeds out onto the soil, and this little seed over here suddenly grows up as a plant years later. Good grief, I never even knew I said that. How frightful a responsibility is to be a teacher. I guess everybody's got their least favorite verse in the Bible. My least favorite verse is the one, I think it's in James' epistles. He says to a congregation, "Brethren, do not many of you want to be teachers, because teachers will be judged more strictly."
It seems that we've, in some of your arguments, are discounting or disclaiming the fact of Jesus' divinity.
Why?
I'm just saying, what about the argument of experience? David, Solomon, and William James's variety of religious experience. I'm sure many of us here have had close encounters with God. What about that experience?
I don't quite understand the question.
The argument of perception or experience of God being here with us.
I think that's a very probable argument. If people who are wise and trustable in other ways claim to have had experiences of God, we ought to at least listen to them and follow them. Definitely. And even if you don't believe Jesus was divine, you've got to believe that he's a fool to be an atheist. Because there's nobody who made God more central to his whole life.
I actually think there are some very interesting objections to each of your points, right, but I'm not going to get into them since we don't have much time.
Take one.
Well, actually, I have a more overarching question that I'd like to ask. And that question is that, one of the easiest responses to why the existence of God is not clear to everyone, you know, why we would even have this conversation tonight, is, you know, people's hearts are clouded by sin, they do not truly seek, and so forth. At least in my own experience, and many people I've known, I'm not convinced by that. I think that there are people who are truly seeking, that are truly open, but do not find God to be clearly present at all. So my question would be, why would God hide himself, so to speak? And why not make himself more clear? And more specifically, why faith as the big leap as opposed to love? Why not say, here I am, now choose to love me, as opposed to first decide whether I'm there or not?
That's an excellent question. C.S. Lewis wrote a whole book, his best book, I think, in answer to that question. It's a fictional novel called Till We Have Faces. I won't even begin to summarize it. It's a brilliant story. Your question is Bertrand Russell's question. On his deathbed, a preacher came to Russell and said, "Bertie, you're going to die in a few days. You're a lifelong atheist. Suppose you find out that there is a God. What would you say to him?" And Russell said,
"Well, I suppose I should have to say, sir..."
Evidently, you should call him sir, mark of respect and all of that.
"Sir, evidently you do exist, and my hypothesis of atheism was erroneous. Would you mind answering me one wee little question? Why didn't you give us more evidence?"
That's the philosopher's question. I used to think that was a very good question. And like you, I used to think that many people are searching for God but can't find him. And the explanation that sin has darkened the human heart was just too dark. When I was a Calvinist, I thought Calvinism was too dark. Now I think I have more of respect for Calvinism than I ever did as a Calvinist. Because I think as we get older, we know our own hearts a little better. And I think there's a lot of truth in that answer. In fact, I think that the reason God gives us so little light is that he sees that we need a lot of heart exercise. We need a lot of running after him. He plays hide and seek with us. He whispers in the ear and then runs away. Why? So that we run and run and run, and then when we finally find him, we find ourselves too, because we've developed the muscles. In other words, what he wants is lovers. He doesn't just want accurate philosophers who have the truth. He wants lovers. So even the greatest saints are in dark nights of the soul. They don't see God. They work by pure faith. In a sense, you have less certainty, not more, as you progress in the love of God, because he tests you more. Do you really love me? Lovers do not propose in syllogisms. Romeo didn't carry a battery of lawyers with him to Juliet to convince her that she had to marry him. So that's my psychological answer. I think he gives enough light so that those who truly love him will find him, but not so much light that those who don't want him will find him.
I'm not a quantum physicist by any stretch of the imagination, but what would you say to the person who takes the particular view of quantum physics, namely the idea of the wave-particle experiment in Schrödinger's cat? I'm not sure if you're familiar with
that. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle?
Yes, and say that on the basis of that, at the heart of the universe, we do not find causality, which, of course, is the basis of reasoning, which is what we're doing.
Well, I'd first say that the causal argument doesn't talk about the microscopic world at all. It talks about the macroscopic world. Secondly, I'm not a physicist, so I have no authority on the subject whatsoever, but Einstein makes a lot of sense to me when he criticizes Heisenberg and says that that's got to be an epistemological limitation, not an ontological limitation. You cannot imagine something really having no determinate position or velocity once it's observed. If the act of observation, due to the finite speed of light, interferes physically with the object, it can be understood. But the mere consciousness of an object cannot possibly change the object, because then it's not the object of which you're conscious. It's a different one. So I think there's a logical self-contradiction built into that version of Heisenberg's principle. But I'm not sure whether that was Heisenberg's version. Ask John Polkinghorne.
Thank you very much.
Hi. You pointed out that New Agers are so deluded because they think they're God rather than admitting that we all yearn for God. And also pointed out that the central tenet of Christianity is that God came down to be one of us. But philosophically speaking, why is it okay for God to be man and not okay for man to be God?
Oh, I see who you are now. You are the Sibylline Oracle. You are the inscription over the Temple of Apollo, Gnothis Auton, yes. A very good question. Not only is it not permitted for us to be God, but it is commanded for us to be God. The Eastern Orthodox call this theosis. It is our destiny. God will share his very life with us. We will become part of the family. The thing that I criticize in the New Age movement is not their ideal of a meeting of the divine and the human, but the means. Their means are human rather than divine. They don't depend upon divine grace. They depend on human effort.
Okay. Thank you.
Almost all of your arguments, they are based on the assumption that if there is a God, he is always a creator. What about a God who is not a creator?
How interesting. How old are you? That's a pagan idea. Am I speaking to an ancient Greek now? Frankly, I've never given that much of a thought. That's the first time anybody has ever asked me that question. If you mean a god like Zeus or Apollo or Poseidon or someone like that. Or if you mean God as some vague principle like goodness, truth, and beauty, I wouldn't call that God. I'd call that an idea.
Thanks. I guess there's one particular argument about your argument from a desire which we never find completed, and I probably misunderstood the argument, but one objection would be that we do experience desires for all kinds of things, which we find partially completed, but my desire for food is always greater than I should and often can actually satisfy. And other desires, such as for sex or for all kinds of pleasures, we actually can't satisfy completely or to the extent that we would like to. So we experience a lot of natural desires which are actually unable to be satisfied. So why should another one for happiness, for example, lead us to think that there is some further happiness which it does exist?
With the possible exception of sexual desire, and maybe the desire of the surfer for the perfect wave, I think every other desire can be satisfied temporarily. After you've had a delicious meal, you don't want to eat more at that time. Your hunger is not there anymore. It'll be there in 6 hours, but it's not there now. Sexual desire is different in that there's an ecstasy, a standing outside the self that's involved there that's not present in ordinary desires, like for food or even for human society. So there's something much more mystical about that, which probably accounts for the fact that that desire is vastly in, the demand is in exceed of the supply. As C.S. Lewis puts it, if everybody ate as much as they want, the world could still supply all the food. But if everybody had as much sex as they want, every male would populate an entire village. So what we want, I think, in sexual desire, and maybe in a few others, is that of which sex is an icon. What I'm looking for in looking for the perfect wave as a very poor but fanatical surfer is really God. I want to surf on God. And even if I find the perfect wave, I say that's just an icon.
Hi. From your arguments, I take the premise that God exists, and I heard you use the term sinners
earlier.
That's
not my premise. That's my conclusion.
Okay, your conclusion that's sinners, so therefore we're less than perfect.
Yeah.
How do you have perfection and imperfection coexist, because once imperfection touches perfection, now we have imperfection?
Oh, it can't. That's the deepest answer to why good people suffer, because the sculptor has to perfect his statue, and we're far from perfect, so we need a lot of cooking.
How you doing? I do believe in God. I believe that there's a God that does exist, and he orchestrates our lives. Everything that we do, everything that we say, this conversation I'm having with you right now was all predetermined. My question is, the fact that you posed the question about whether or not God exists, how can we or should we believe that God in itself is a person, can be visible? You understand what I'm saying? Maybe I'm not wording it right. Okay. Tough one, huh?
Some of the arguments for the existence of God just prove that there's some sort of creator. Others, like the moral argument, or an argument I didn't give you, the argument from consciousness, the analogy of the brain as a computer is close to that, I think prove that God is not just a force, but a person with a mind and a will. Because design requires a mind, and a moral law requires a will. Then the next question is, has this God, who is perfect and all-powerful and a mind and a will, has this God ever intervened, made himself visible, come into our world, done miracles? In order to answer that question, you have to look at history and the historical evidence.
If I may, one other question I have is the belief in the Bible. It chronicles things from thousands of years ago that we're experiencing today. Now, the fact that there is supposedly, and I believe there is, a God who wrote this book anticipatory of the things that we're going through now, can you give me some sort of...
Yes. The Bible is one of the biggest pieces of historical evidence. There's no book like it. The fulfilled prophecies, the total lack of historical contradictions, it's an amazing book. Looked at by the same standards as you look at any other books, it'll stand out as unique.
Given the logical consistency of your arguments, your presentation, there's one thing that I probably didn't understand, and I just need some clarification. You said that if any of us answered yes to the question of wanting to meet God in the next 2 minutes, if that were an option, we would have to be either, I think you said, a great saint or a great fool.
Yeah.
Yet, since God is love, and since he does if I understood other portions of your presentation correctly, he does love even sinners. Why would we not? And why would one have to be a fool to desire that, even if one were not a great saint?
Because love is not spelled L-U-V. It's spelled capital L-O-V-E. And love is like a volcano. The love of God makes God more formidable, not less. Because love, absolute love, perfect love, infinite love, is utterly intolerant of any imperfection in the beloved. If one of you ladies came up to me and said, Professor, can I have a minute of your time? I want your advice here. I'm losing a lot of money and I don't know how to pay my taxes, so I think I'm going to become a prostitute. You think it's a good idea? I would say, no, I think it's a stupid idea. Go away. I'm not interested. But if my wife said that, I wouldn't just say, go away, it's a stupid idea. I'd shout and scream. The more you love somebody, the more you expect of them. We expect the most of the people we love the most. So if God loves us infinitely, his expectations, his demands on us are so vastly excessive of what we are that when we meet him, we fall down on our feet as one dead. Imagine your father. Jesus' primary image for God is father. When you got an F on your report card when you were in elementary school, the other kids laughed at it, and maybe your teacher frowned, but you didn't want to meet your father then. Why? Because he had much higher expectations of you. Well, God is father with a capital F.
But a forgiving father with a capital F for forgiveness, right?
Yes, absolute love and absolute forgiveness. And the worst thing about us is the pride with which we don't accept that forgiveness. Because in order to accept forgiveness, you have to admit that you're a sinner.
Got time for two more questions.
I love your book, Making Sense Out of Suffering. It probably is the most helpful thing I ever read on that subject. But it's always seemed to me that there are two different kinds of suffering. I'm tempted to say that the only really compelling argument against the existence of God was formulated by a much deeper mind than mine. I think it was Dostoevsky who said the only compelling argument against the existence of God is the suffering of children. Now, if God sees every sparrow's fall, then why doesn't he see it when a little kid crawls into an abandoned refrigerator and shuts the door? Again, the two different kinds of suffering. I've never been a mother, but I think if I had a child who got very sick and died in my arms, I think maybe with the help of faith and prayer, I might be able to go on with life. But if I had a child who was kidnapped by a pervert and tortured and buried in a ditch someplace, I don't see myself emerging from that with any kind of faith at all. And that's what I mean by the two different kinds of suffering. It seems like there's a kind of suffering that, sad as it is, we can see being redemptive in some way, but there's another kind of suffering that just doesn't make any sense at all. And that's when I'm tempted to believe, well, you know, maybe there isn't any God and it's all just nonsense.
Let's think of that horrible situation. You're a mother, you have a beloved child, the child gets tortured, kidnapped, raped. Three people here, you, the child's torturer. Where's God? Well, if God is out there watching merely and doing nothing, then it takes an enormous amount of faith to say, well, God knows what he's doing. I don't know why he doesn't intervene. I wish he would, but he doesn't. So that's all there is to it. That kind of God, the merely watching God, is almost like the God of the torturer, because the torturer is not treating your child as a human being and not treating you as a human being, but treating the child as an object. And if God is only watching, he's treating us as objects. That's not the kind of God the Bible talks about. The God of the Bible is invisible because he's too close. First of all, he's in you. He's in your mother's heart. And for a Christian, the final and definitive revelation of who God is like is Jesus Christ. And when Jesus' close friend Lazarus died, what did he do? He wept.
Right.
So every single human tear is a divine tear. Remember that scene in Mel Gibson's The Passion where the tear falls from heaven? Finally, God is in your child. God is in that innocent victim. Because when he became a human being, he became an innocent victim.
Remember that incredibly moving scene in The Passion where Mary, seeing Jesus on the way to the cross, remembers how when he was a little kid, he fell down and she could go up and pick him up. He can't do that now. He falls down under the cross. She can't pick him up. And she says to him, "Why do you have to do all this?" And he turns to her and says, "See, Mother, I make all things new." That's a funny kind of answer to the problem of evil, but it's the only one that satisfies the heart.
And maybe the only answer there is.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Last question.
Your representation of Bertrand Russell is the best I've ever heard.
quite.
I knew Maliki Martin very well, the Jesuit priest, one of your greatest authors. And it was he who taught me, and I've since discovered that this is corroborated abundantly, that the only name to which evil spirit responds in exorcism is that of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Is not that a perfect confirmation of the existence of God?
Yes, it is. It is not a proof, it is a confirmation. I have never seen an exorcism performed, but I've talked to people who have. And the movie, the 40-year-old movie, The Exorcist, which caused an incredible commotion, some of it very deep and religious, as was caused by no other movie. I think The Exorcist and The Passion are probably the two movies that have discombobulated human hearts the most. That was based on a real case. Yes. And that's why it was so moving. And the sequels weren't. Yeah, it happens.
Well, it's certainly what catapulted me towards Christ.
Yeah. And to come back to my very first point, William James's point about the difference that a belief makes. If we are in a world where there is just secularity and neutrality as one option, and God and the infinite good as another option, then God might be the icing on the cake. But if we are in a world where there is perpetual warfare between good and evil, starting with our own heart, then you need God as much as you need a life raft.
I know you said last question, Eric, but may I just humbly suggest to Dr. Crafe that perhaps the answer to the child being kidnapped and raped is the great fact of free will. Free will was given to us by God, and that rapist misused his free will upon the child.
That explains the origin of it. That explains the cause of it. God respects our free will so much. But deep down, the mother doesn't want God to respect free will that much.
Well, when but God the mother performs, doesn't control the universe.
When God performs a spectacular miracle, I like to say, I love it when he does stuff like that. Why doesn't he do it more often? Well, right. His love respects our freedom so amazingly
that
we don't like it. So that's half the answer. The other half is not just what he didn't do, namely turn us into robots and perform frontal lobotomies before people got bad thoughts, but what he did do. See the movie or read the book.
Thank you so much, Dr. Crafe.